Oh, sorry. The
Department
of Social
Media.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so thanks a lot for having me. I want to extend my
great thanks to Luke for inviting me here. We had a very productive week last week, and I'm very happy to tell you a bit about other work that I've been doing. Yeah, so before I begin, I thought I'd introduce my university a little bit, because I think most people are not familiar with it. So Keio University is actually, by some standards, the oldest university in Japan. Already established in 1858, and the founder of Keio University is Kichi Fukuzawa, and he's actually, the image is on the 10,000 yen bill, so if you ever want to put it, you'll see a lot of it. So it's quite a big university. There are six main campuses, and our campus, where I work, is here in Miyoshi, which is actually just in Yokohama across the border from Tokyo. So here's the central Tokyo, and this is here. Okay, so let's talk about physics. What I want to talk about today is what I call quantum liquid crystals. I'll tell you what I mean by that a bit later. But the outline is that first I want to talk about defect unwinding phase transitions in general, and then specialize a bit to quantum liquid crystals later. First, in plus-one dimensions, where everything is quite quantum control, and also tell you about the extension to 3 plus 1 dimensions later. And if I get to it, there are some experimental, this theory may be relevant for experiments, very recent experiments, and if there's some time, I'll tell you about that too. I don't really know what people are most interested in here, so there are several angles to my talk. If you want to know about something more specific, we can please interrupt and tell me so I can elaborate at that moment. And I don't mind if I skip some other things, so please. Alright, so first I'll make a brief outline or summary of the talk in the beginning. So, everybody knows since 2 years, at least 2 years ago, the Nobel Prize was awarded what the Bernoulli Costello-Stahl phase transition is. It's the idea that in two dimensions, the topological defects, so if you have a U1 symmetry gradient, those are vortices, are point-like particles, and you can look at both the energy and the entropy contribution of those particles. Now, the energy of a single vortex goes as a logarithm of the system size, the linear system size. It's just because the separation between a vortex and an anti-vortex grows logarithmically with separation. Right? So if you have an isolated one, it's the system size. Now, the entropy of a single vortex is just counting the units of area where you can put one vortex in. So that also still the logarithm of the area, which is of course proportional to the logarithm of the linear system size. And then you can see that in the free energy, you just have a balance between energy and entropy, which will be dictated by the temperature. So if the temperature is very low, then the energy dominates. It's too costly to make a vortex, and vortices are always bound to their anti-vortex. While high energy, these two can unbind, and then you get a phase transition. Okay? Now, in this argument, I've used nothing specific to U1 symmetry gradient. So this should apply to any topological defects in two-dimensional systems, right? And already in their first paper, Costello-Stahl acknowledged this, and they say that if you talk about solids, the topological defects are dislocations. So they say isolated dislocations cannot occur at low temperatures, but then if this inequality is violated, the largest pairs become unstable and they unbind. So today I want to talk about unbinding of dislocations in solids, but not at zero temperature, not as a thermal phase transition, but as a zero temperature quantum phase transition. Now,
A small question.
Yeah.
So when you mentioned that the separation grows logarithmically with the length scale,
yeah.
This is generic, not only for superconductivity, but
yeah, so
like
basically,
in general?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's very generic.
Okay, and it's only in 2D?
In two dimensions,
okay.
Yes. Actually, in three dimensions, those pi 1 topological defects become lines, and then usually the interaction between two lines is also logarithmic separation. But of course, if they are not aligned, you get corrections. But if you have two straight lines, the energy grows at the separation between them, logarithmic.
With no extra power law in L, in the distance. Just
logarithmic.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay, So in the early paper, they already talk about this dislocation unbinding, but they did not realize that actually it's in solids, you create two kinds of symmetries, not only translational symmetry, but also rotational symmetry, and they each come with their own topological defects. And so things are a bit more subtle than in the superfluids, where you're only one type, and this was later in the 70s repaired, and then what you can have is that if you start from a solid where all symmetry is broken, first you do this unbinding of dislocations, which are the translational topological defects, and later you unbind the rotational topological defects, which are called disclinations, and in between, so from a solid to a liquid, in between there's another phase, which they call the hexapic, and this is a phase where translational symmetry is restored, but rotational symmetry is still broken. And this phase, I will take this as the definition of a liquid crystal. So something with translational symmetry, the broken rotational symmetry.
Is it always? So is the pattern of symmetry breaking is always like you explained? For the translation?
This, yes, and the reason is that you can view this one as a whole bunch of dislocations. So you can write this one as every dislocation here, every dislocation here, every dislocation here. So they are energetically much more plastic. So as long as translational symmetry is still broken, you will never see this in reality, only very tightly bound. So the dislocation binding, for energetic reasons, always comes through. There is a possibility that they unbind at the same time. And then these two phase transitions merge, and then you get a first order solid to liquid phase transition, basically the ordinary solid to liquid phase transition. But if you can somehow keep them apart, which happens in some systems, then you have this phase in between.
So that's just energy arguments, but what about the entropy?
Well, entropy is just, in the earlier argument, it's just the size of the dislocation. So,
right, so
the way
so it's the same argument.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so now I want to do quantum phase transitions. This one is, of course, here, perimeter very well known. So the idea of quantum phase transitions is that instead of having a temperature doing the difference between order and disorder, you have some other tuning parameter, for instance, density, or we have a field, or what have you, chemical doping, that can tune between one ordered phase and another phase. And in many occasions, this is not just an order disorder transition, but actually a transition between two phases with their own type of order. So I want to look today, I'm only going to look at the zero temperature axis, but this very general scheme or scheme of quantum phase just tells you that this should persist at finite temperature as well, and the properties of the quantum critical point at zero temperature will be noticeable at finite temperature as well, meaning that you, if you do real experiments, you should be able to see this. Okay, so I want to elaborate a bit more on what I just said, is that if you, in ordinary means with Landau picture of phase transitions, right, you do always do symmetry break. So you go from a disordered state to something which is more ordered, or something which is more symmetric to something which is less symmetric. Right. But you can also look the other way. So you say, you start in a very ordered state, I'm interested in how this becomes more disordered. So melting type phase transitions. And the way this is done is what I just mentioned, is by proliferation or condensation of topological defects. Right, so if you take this again, then you can say that this is your order phase, and it's disordered, and I will do dislocation unbinding. Or you can start here and say this is symmetric, and I do the ordinary type of symmetry breaking, but you can turn it around as well. Right, so you just look at this has some type of order, it also has some kind of topological defects, and if I proliferate drops, I can go back. So this is actually a duality, right? If you can do some duality mapping, some mathematical duality mapping, then depending on which side I choose, I'm viewing that as the ordered state with its topological defects. This is not completely general, but this is also mentioned.
Okay. Yeah, I was gonna ask, you're sort of assuming that the, say, critical exponents that you compute going from left to right or right to left are the same, but that's not usually the case, right?
Here, if there's a duality, it will be the case.
Okay.
So if the duality holds, then it should be. Sorry, that's not entirely. The duality need not be a self-duality, right? So, what do you mean? I mean that if you map your theory to some other theory, that other theory needs to be, not, need to be identical to the other one. And the ones I will show you are actually not self-dual. So basically, but of course if you do the duality transformation twice, you get back to you.
Okay.
I will show this explicitly. Okay, so here is the pictorial way of what I will tell about later with some equations. The machinery that we use will be a quantum field theory of topological defects, particles. So we're going to view the topological defects as being particle-like and then doing quantum field theory of that. Right? And you know that, so let's talk about two dimensions. A two-dimensional field theory will be equivalent to a deepest one-dimensional statistical field theory or statistical physics. For instance, it's known that the two-dimensional superfluid insulator transition is a U1 phase transition. It's in the 3D XY inverse of class, as far as critical properties are concerned. Right? And this is the way you look at it. So if you have this plane is the spatial plane, and then time is going in the vertical direction. And then if you have a vortex, then this line will be the world line of the vortex in space-time. Right? So I'm going to look at statistical physics of these world lines, topological defects. And then in order phase, I will have that these, I told you that the defect anti-defect pairs are very tightly bound, meaning that the loops in space-time of maybe small vortex and anti-vortex pair are very small. But then if you go more and more disordered, the loops can grow, and across the phase transition, they have been just as large as the system size. And then you have the proliferation or of topological defects or otherwise, yeah.
Oh, which is the parameter that you change?
It depends on the system, right? But for instance, if I talk about, later I'll talk about helium monolayers, then it will be the density of helium. So at low density, it will be disordered, and high density, it will be ordered. Yeah, so it's a fixed temperature, typically zero temperature, but in experiments that means a very low temperature, you choose something else, which makes the system more or less boring. But there are many others. For instance, in high temperature superconductors, usually in the phase diagram, it's a chemical doping. So the amount of extra electron or hole carriers as compared to the density. It can be in the end. Okay, so this is the picture. It's this kind of proliferation or unbinding of defects in this world line picture. Okay, so this general thing I want to apply to what I call quantum liquid crystals. So by quantum liquid crystal, I mean any quantum system which has the same symmetry as a classical liquid crystal. So basically, full translational symmetry and some broken rotational symmetry. Yeah, so this started in the context of high temperature superconductors with this paper in 1998, where they said that if you, so these high temperature conductors are maybe doped not insulator. So if you have an insulator, you put more and more disorder, you get more carriers, and those carriers then at some point maybe start to superconduct. These carriers, these electrons, they can all do all kinds of other orderings, perhaps even spatial orderings, right? So it's known that they have stripes, which now quite well confirmed. And then they thought if these stripes, they're spatial ordering, they can also have topological defects, which are actually dislocations. And if those dislocations become more and more prolific, then maybe you can make something like a liquid crystal. So that is how this all started. So they very much thinking of the cuprates. And then more than 5 years later, Simon Lusinov and Lutin, they thought, can we write the most general theory having to do with is quantum liquid crystals so the liquid crystal idea in a quantum set, in a quantum and quantum system. So this is quite applied, and this is starting from what would be how the most general theory apply. And what I told you about today is basically an extension or the results of this idea. Now I want to mention here that if you go on archive and you look at quantum liquid crystal or the word quantum mechanics, that is related, but maybe looking at the same thing from the completely opposite side. So by quantum mechanics, people usually mean that that if you start from some Fermi surface which has some rotational symmetry, then that rotational symmetry can be spontaneously broken. Right? For instance, if you have the cooperage, typically you have in plane, you have fourfold symmetry, and that can be spontaneously broken to a twofold symmetry. And that is what people usually mean by quantum mathematics. But so this is basically a recoupling picture in the sense that you still start from the Fermi surface and then look at that. So while we start completely from the opposite side, so the most strongly correlated things that you can imagine, and then try to do symmetry considerations of that.
So in the first one that you mentioned, you're neglecting completely the fermions, or
yeah, everything I talk about will be bosons.
Okay.
Yeah. But still, the results may apply to Fermi systems, but we just theoretically cannot handle.
Okay.
It's kind of slightly irrelevant in the sense that we only look at the collective physics, and we only look at the collective field, and that should be typically bosonic.
Sure. But what about the interaction of that collective field with the fermions? That presumably they still form a Fermi surface.
Sure. Yeah. That is maybe something that we can do in the future, but we're not there. Okay. So now I want to start. Before we do quantum liquid crystals, I want to do something which is called vortex boson duality two dimensions. In high energy physics, this is called Abelian Higgs duality. And it's always a nice introduction to do a bit more complicated things. I thought I'd do it on the blackboard. That's okay. Is this fine?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay, so let's say, in a superfluid. So in a superfluid, you have a complex scalar field. Right, and the amplitude and the phase, and I'm going to keep the amplitude fixed, and I'm only going to look at the phase fluctuations. Right, so then I start from a partition function, this. I'm going to work in imaginary time only, so only put the relativistic in imaginary time. Okay, so this g is the coupling constant, right? And it's basically the amplitude of the square of the amplitude. And I only look at the low energy excitation, so only this part. Okay. Now, you can define the canonical momentum. If you integrate out w from this function integral, you get back to here. So this is basically identical to doing Haber-Sultanovich transformation. Right? So this is identical. Okay, now I'm going to say that, of course, I had this phase field. I say I only talk about low energy excitations, but it used to be a compact U1 variable. So I should also take the vortices into account. And so the vortices are 2 pi windings of the phase field, and at the center there must be singularity in the phase. So if I want to take those into account as well, I should add them in this field. So I have a smooth part, which are basically the Goldstone models and the singular configurations, and I just separate them explicitly, and I put it in here. here. But now this part is smooth, completely smooth. So I'm going to do integration by parts, taking the derivative here. Like this, right? And now this, the smooth field appears only linearly in this path integral, so I can integrate it out as a constraint. Right? That's my branch multiplier for a constraint, and then you find that this part must be zero. That's the constraint. This is basically the conservation of supercurrent in the superfluid. Because of this constraint, I can now express this field as the curl of some other field. Right, so I introduced this new field B, it's a gauge field, because I can add the gradient of any scalar field to this field, and then mu will be the same. So this definition I put back in this function, so now it goes as follows. I should put in a gauge fixing factor here for the B field, but I won't write it down. Smooth, so you can do integration by parts here to the other side. Okay. So here you see non-commuting derivatives. Right, but you usually vanish, that because this field is singular, it doesn't vanish. So now I'm going to define the vortex current as follows. Base field, which has some field strength, and it couples to an external source. So this looks just like Maxwell electromagnetism in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Okay? So what's happened is that we started from this Rolleston mode, which we dualized into this gauge field, B field, this one, and it couples to something. What it couples to, or what it's sourced by, is the vortices of the. And if you now, now you can write down, right, you can integrate out B, and then you can look at the vortex-vortex interaction, and then you will exactly find this logarithm that I talked about earlier, right? That the energy cost is logarithmic in the separation.
So what prevents this to work in three dimensions, or does
I'll
it work?
I'll talk about it later.
Okay.
Yeah? Because the point will be here.
I see.
Yeah, because I've taken the curl in three dimensions, or in 2 plus 1 dimensions.
Okay.
And what allowed me 3 dimensions is that I can still take a curl of something, but it will be a two-form gauge. So this is just, I've written down here what I did on the blackboard. So this is the end result, right? And so we can say that the superfluid is actually a Coulomb vacuum for vortices. The vortices are like electric charges in vacuum, and they have long-range interactions, and those interactions are mediated by photons. So those photons are times dual gauge fields, and they represent the Boltzmann amount. The technical point is that this is not a path integral over the vortices, it's a path integral over the worldwide elements of isolated vortices. I cannot, at this point, we cannot do, let's say, a primary ensemble for a spectral delay. Okay, so now we want to look at the phase transition, so where the vortices condense or differate. And what we have to do is that these vortices become a collective field. Right? So you cannot no longer talk about an individual vortex if you have a composite of vortices. It's the same thing in superconductor, you have no such thing as a single group of pairs in superconductor. So you must talk about a collective field, so I'm going to introduce a complex scalar field phi. And the heuristic correspondence between these vortex sources there before and this collective field is like this, right? But the J's are only defined well, or well defined in the ordered phase, in the superfluid, while this is only defined when there's no longer so. Yeah? So, on a lattice in three dimensions without time, you can actually derive the following result. That I want to look at, let's say, loop gas of these vortex loops, right? So the loops in three dimensions are like the world lines in 2+1 dimensions. And then you can show that this path integral will lead to just the ordinary action of Ginsburg non-Laplace for this collective field. Right? And this factor alpha determines whether you're condensing or not. And it turns out that this is proportional to the exponent of the line tension minus some constant. Right? So the line tension are these vortex loops. So if the line tension is very high, then loops will be small. If the line tension is low, loops, they will unwind, right? But they will condense. So this can be derived explicitly in 3D, and I'm all the time resting on this result that this will also generalize to other cases. Even though we cannot do it explicitly. So, So if you have a vortex composite, currently it's a neutral, so I only have vortices without interactions between them, then it will be of this type, and they can condense according to the line tension, and I'm assuming that this line tension can be tuned by this external parameter that we were talking about here. Yeah? And then we know that these vortices were coupled or charged with these dual gauge fields, so now I'm just going to add that here. So we had this Ginsburg-Laplace potential, they're coupled, and we had this just a kinetic term earlier. And this is exactly the action of a relativistic superconductor, right? So if now these vortices condense, and this term comes into play, then I'll have the disordering phase transition switching from a superfluid to some phase, which is dual to a superconductor. So that's written here. And what is now the consequence of that is that the dual photons, these base fields, now take up an Anderson Higgs mass, and that means that they are Meissner, right? They fall off exponentially in this new medium that we have. Remember that those photons represent the Goldstone models. So the Goldstone models would just be massless, now take up a mass, and they fall off exponentially in this new medium. And this we take as a sign that the long-range order, which was there in the superfluid, is now lost, right? There's no rigidity because rigidity cannot be communicated anymore by the coefficients. So this is the disordering phase transition. Yeah, so now you can make a dictionary. So everything which you know from electromagnetism should translate to this medium, the disordered superfluid, which comes from the with this dual gauge, right? So what used to be photons, or what are photons in the electromagnetism are now gauge bosons, and if you have a superconductor, that's of course also the vortices, and what you have the superconducting gap is now these massive gauge bosons. And the expulsion of the supercurrent is now given by the dual Meissner. Right? So you have now a medium which cannot sustain supercurrent anymore, and that's what we call an insulated. So this is actually a superfluid insulated. I want to talk about this.
So are any other questions at this point?
I'm just curious about when you say superconducting gap and massive bosons are sort of dual to each other. You can still have superconductivity without a gap. Is there anything equivalent here?
I'm just talking about the superconductivity for lambda theory.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so now I want to go to crystal. So what is actually crystal? Crystal is dimensions is a medium that breaks fluctuations and rotations in spatial or space. Because you break a d-translational symmetry, you have d-formats. I'll talk a bit later about the rotational conformals. It's a bit subtle, but it's known and understood that you don't see the rotational conformals in only the formats. The hallmark of this crystal is that you have shear rigidity. Shear rigidity leads to having of these polynomials, d minus 1 are obviously transverse. You have one longitudinal one. Longitudinal one you already have in the fluids or the liquid, right? But the transverse ones are the hallmark of having this translation symmetry. The topological defects associated with the translational symmetry are called the dislocations. We've seen them earlier. And the topological charge is not just a winding number or an integer, but it's actually a vector, which should be on the lattice. It's a lattice vector. But for now, you can think of them as just having a winding number in each spatial direction. Now we're going to dualize this in the same way as I did before. So we have these polynomials, they will become vector bosons, and now I carry this additional label because I have d of them. Right? So this upper label counts the space directions. Then if I have the dislocations and I do this compensation, locations, they will restore the translation symmetry, and that will mean that these transfer formats are gaps. And that will be the hallmark of restoring translation symmetry. And there's a constraint coming from mass conservation that means the longitudinal formula will be protected. Just let's say a fluid also has a longitudinal formula. So this is what I'm looking for, and this is what I will argue is going to happen. Okay? Yeah, so in the superfluid, we had this phase mode. And if the vortices condense, you will find this gap, which is the insulating gap. And now in the solid, it will be as follows. You will see the phonons, dislocations will condense, and then you find the gas for shear stress, or for the transfer phonons. Okay, so the object that I will work with is the stress tensor. The stress tensor is basically the generalization of this supercurrent W. And it has an additional label A coming from the space directions. You can classify the types of stress you have in the crystal as follows. That's important now. So basically you can do this the same thing where you should replace the phase field phi with this displacement field. So the displacement field is just small displacements in direction A. And then what's to do with the stress tensor, which we just see. And you can do the same game with integrating out the smooth fields, and you find that the stress tensor must be conserved as follows. And you introduce these new dual gauge fields here. So the lambda is the same as before, it's just a world line index or space time index. And now I have the additional label A coming from the basically, for each A, there's one formula. Right? So here we specialize again to 2 plus 1 dimensions. In 3 plus 1 dimensions, it will be more complicated. I'll show you later. Yeah, so you can also see how the topological defects arise. So you have these singular configurations in the displacement field. And then this part, I will say, is dislocation current. It looks as follows. You have this, again, the world line index of the dislocation. And the topological charge, the upper label A. So this will be basically X, Y, or Z, giving the Burgers vector. Right, and again I have this, this is the dual expression for elasticity in a solid, where the stress degrees of freedom are here. This contains now the coupling constant, so here I only have one coupling constant, G, but here we can be several depending on the symmetries of the crystal. and the dislocation is just vector sources. Right? So again, before the generalization is that the solid is like a Coulomb vacuum for dislocations which have long range interactions.
What's the meaning of the quotes in the...
Yeah, again, we're not doing a real quantum field theory of dislocations at this point. I'm looking basically at strength test charges. But of course, since they're world lines, I can integrate over the fluctuations of the world line. This is the Gates fixing factor. Okay. So if I do the same thing as before, if I make a composite of dislocations, you can do this disorder field theory, and you should arrive at something which is with Gibbs with lambda type. This part is maybe the most important, but we cannot do it explicitly. We haven't been able to find a way to do on the lattice and make these loops of dislocations. So at this point, we just assume that something similar will happen, and it will be okay. Same thing for lambda type. Okay? So here I've specialized in two dimensions, then you have two types of dislocations. So I call them, let's say, the x direction and the y direction. They can each condense in separately, at least a priori. Right? So I have two condensate fields, x and y, and I have Gibbs lambda alpha and beta parameters for each of them, and there can be a coupling, density-density coupling here. So this is the more general thing I can write down. And then you have the Gibbs fields, they couple as follows. It's basically the same thing. So for each direction, the appropriate phonon can couple to the dislocation, right? So, I mean, here there's no index A, but I mean, I should do this for each dislocation separately. It's basically a U1 cross U1. And then this lambda is what I talked about earlier about. This enforces this glide constraint, meaning that longitudinal phonons will always remain massless. It can be expressed like this quite concisely, and it works just as I say it does. Okay, so this coupling term like this, and if I say the amplitude is constant, then I will just take out the amplitude of here. And then you only have to phase degrees of freedom. So this is the ordinary. Okay, so before I talk about quantum liquid crystals, let's remind quickly what type of classical liquid crystals you can have. So in a solid, a classical solid is just, let's say, a bunch of molecules or constituent particles, and they are rotationally and translationally ordered like this. A liquid is where everything is completely disordered, and I can have some phases in between. So if I start from the solid, I can have still order in one direction, let's say vertical direction, but disorder in another direction, right? And rotational symmetry is always broken. So this is called a symmetric liquid crystal, where I restore one translational symmetry. And then I can have a phase where all translational symmetry is restored, rotational symmetry is still broken. That's called a nematic liquid crystal. And here I want to mention that for my purposes, I will call everything, every phase which has broken rotations, restore translation cinematic, even though in classical liquid crystals, this is only applied to these phases where you have the Z2 remaining symmetry, right? But for me, yeah, so the distinction, I want to look at I'm interested in the small, the low energy excitations, and it doesn't really matter what the remnant rotational group is, a discrete rotational group that you have left, it doesn't matter for the, let's say, both the model structures. So everything which has full translational symmetry, I'll call it a net. Okay, so with that in mind, let's now look at the phase diagram coming from the dislocation compensation. The sign of this alpha is switched, so this would be minus one, this would be plus one. I assume for the simplicity that the two alphas are the same and the two betas are the same and have three parameters. If alpha is negative, then I have condensation. If it's positive, nothing condenses, that's just the phase that I started with. And then if alpha is negative, you'll have some condensate, and then it's a function of the coupling between them, first the fourth power interaction. You can have two cases. So if the interaction is small enough, if gamma is small enough, let's say zero, then they are exactly the same. So both condense in the same way, and this is what I call a net, right? Both dislocations with dislocations with Burgers vector in both directions, they were condensed, all translational symmetry is restored, and then I'm in a metric difference. If the interaction is very strong, then the system prefers to have only one dislocation condensation. So one of these two, which will be chosen spontaneously because everything is isotropic here, will condense, while the other will remain uncondensed, meaning I restore only one translational symmetry, and that is what I call the SMEC. So this depends on this.
The space diagram is at the mean field level, right?
Yes.
What happens if you include the fluctuations of the collective mole?
Yeah, good question. That's work for later.
Okay.
Actually, something I want to do. Actually, yeah, if you... This is just at mean field level and without the gauge fields yet, right? So,
yeah.
But if you have in a neutral case, where you have no gauge fields, but you do have fluctuations, then it has been shown in quite recent work that this gamma is irrelevant in the renormalization group sense.
To which order?
Sorry,
okay, this is in 2D, 2 plus 1.
That is for... that is for probably 3 dimensions.
Okay.
3 stations.
Okay, makes sense.
I can give you a reference if you're
interested. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so that is basically the results that we have. But now I need to mention about the limitations of this model. It's, of course, I'm talking about zero temperature only. If you want to do finite temperature, you should basically do this quantum phase transitions idea and to be able to be done. As I've seen, everything is of interlambda type, so this means that it should only hold as an effective theory near the phase transition, although we expect that the spectrum is the same by any better continuation, so the number of photons moves also away from the phase transition. I've neglected the amplitude fluctuations, and most importantly, this is for very strongly correlated matter, meaning that I only look at the collective fluctuations of the solid, and individual particle excitations are completely unimportant. So that's the same as this, we don't have interstitial particles or holes in the solid. So it's only true in this limit, and we don't yet know what happens if you go away from this. Maybe if you have slightly less correlated, should be some kind of renormalization of everything that you have, so hopefully it's still applicable also away from boundary limit. So, also, we've assumed that there are no disclinations, comes back to an earlier question. So this should be applied to a system where those rotational degrees of freedom are very strongly suppressed. If you have a system which is not easy to rotationally deform, then maybe it doesn't fall. As I mentioned, we only do bosonic physics, but at least relevant to helium theorems that I may talk about later, the results for helium 4 and 3 are actually quite similar, so hopefully it's still useful also for Fermi physics. And the results I've shown you, actually I didn't talk about it so much, but the calculations we've done explicitly are only for the isotropic solids, meaning that I've taken the minimum number of coupling constants that you can get. It's basically 2. But nothing will go wrong if you have more. It's just more complicated. Okay. Okay, let's see how to do. Let me quickly, I don't want to talk about this too much, so we can get it through. So I'll skip most of this, and I'll just show you one result. That is that we can calculate linear response from the theory that I just talked about. And you can, I've talked about neutral crystals, but you can also talk about charged, so electrically charged crystals. So I mean, crystals made out of constituents which are electrically charged. Then you can interrogate the system with EM fields, and then you can measure, for instance, the transverse conductivity. So if you shine laser light on the system, you look at the response. And then in the transverse conductivity, you see 3 things happening at 0. So this is the spectral, or the transverse conductivity in false color as a function of momentum and energy. So at 0 energy, you see a peak. That's just the perfect droop peak because it's a perfect conductor. And this is because we're in an ideal limit. So if you restore translational symmetry, and so you have a fluid of charged bosons, the only thing they can do is being circumconductive. If you don't have anything else. So that's this one. And then here you see this gapping of the Boltzmann knot. So this gap knot is actually this gap spawner, gap transfer spawner, meaning that you've lost translation symmetry. And we see another mode appearing, which is actually a gapless mode. And this turns out to be a rotation of Boltzmann knots. So interestingly, even though you don't have any rotation of Boltzmann knots in the solid, if you restore translational symmetry while keeping rotational symmetry broken, it appears as a good. And you can also use, so this is a transverse response, if you can also do like energy loss, which is a longitudinal probe, and then you see another gap mode. This is actually the mode of the dislocation condensate itself. Right? So the dislocation condensate is a complex scalar field, which is massive. It has some dynamics of its own, and you can find it in the longitudinal response. So these are two, let's say, hallmarks of the physics that you should find if you can make a quantum liquid crystal, and if you can interrogate it, then experiment with it. They should look for something like this. So now I want to talk about three-plus-one dimensions. The question is, can we still do this in three-plus-one dimensions? So in two-plus-one dimensions, I told you start in space, you have a topological defect as a point particle, and it traces out a world line in space-time. Right? So this is space, this is time, and this is in three plus one dimensions, the topological defects of interest are the pi 1 defects, the first multiple root defects. They are aligned. So you have a line defect, and line defect it extends into the time, or it propagates in the time direction, so you actually have a world sheet. Right? So if I've drawn two space dimensions in the plane, the line is in this plane, and in time it will be a world sheet. Right? A world sheet is parameterized by two. Directions, so I call it mu and mu, and a small world sheet element of this vortex world sheet looks like this, right? So we have this singular displacement field. I take two derivatives to find the topological defect current, and in three-plus-one dimensions it will be a two-form field, and on top of that I still have this the other index, which is the topological charge, so the Burgers spectrum of the Burgers spectrum of the defect. So this is the form in 2 plus 1 dimensions, and I just have this extra space-time index because I have a world sheet. Right? So how do we interpret this new object? If you take one of these components temporal, that's just the density of the line. Right? So if I have a line which points in direction n, then the density of that is just this component, and of course I still have a topological charge. And then if I have two components spatial, that means the current, right? So if I have a line in direction n and it moves in direction m, that's this element. Okay? And the same thing happens for the gauge fields, right? So the dual gauge fields represent the Goldstone modes. I start from the same stress tensor object, but now I take this curl in four dimensions, so I take the curl of a two-form object. So, of course, this matches with this because they couple minimally, right? I think I have this explicitly somewhere. Okay. I'll mention the same thing again in different words, so for your understanding. So the stress tensor has the same structure as before. You have two components. Of course, now they have in more directions. And basically, you have 3 times 4 components. I have 3 conservation laws, that means I have 9 components left. Right? There will be 3 phonons. You have 3 ordinary stress forces, so those are basically the Coulomb forces in the system. And then there's 3 missing, and these will represent the rotational forces. Right? But usually in the collinear order, those are excluded. But if you put higher order, you find the rotational forces, and they actually contain what would be the rotational Goldstone modes. Okay. So now I go to this dual gauge field, and the follows, the upper level is always the space direction, depending on whether you're looking at phonons or stresses in x, y, or z direction. If I have the temporal component, those are just the Coulomb type forces. Right? This part is just the gauge freedom. And then if both, so if I take my two transverse directions, I call them R and S. So if both components, so we have in a two-form field of those two, all of them are transverse, those represent the Goldstone modes. So remember that if you have an ordinary photon field, the director field, the transverse polarizations are propagating modes. So it turns out for a two-form field, if both components are transverse in space, that's the propagating mode. Right? And if A is now all free space directions, meaning the three forms.
Just this is something I don't understand. So if you are in 3D and you are not including declination,
yeah.
Declination are defect when you have curvature, right? So if you are in 3D and you don't include declination, it's like you are in layer. You have like layers of two-dimensional systems.
Not necessarily.
Right?
It just means exactly what you said. You don't take curvature into account. So if you look to linear order elasticity, you cannot talk about curvature. If you want to talk about curvature, you need to take higher order contributions into account. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Okay. Does RNS stand for something like?
Just you have two transverse directions.
Okay.
So I just need to give them some names.
Okay.
Yeah, I cannot do T, right? Because T.
Sure.
One T in the output. Yeah. So the question now is, can we also do this defect compensation in three-dimensional dimension? So it will be right. Dislocation, or here it says vortex, but it means topological defect or dislocation. If there's a composite of topological defects, they are now strings, right? They're vortices, and they interact with two-form Gates fields. So what you should do is now a quantum field theory of string-like objects. So that's not known how to do. Nobody knows how to do it, so also, of course, I do not know how to do it. But you can think of what would happen if you would be able to do it. So here's a problem. So if you take some complex field and you take the fluctuations, now you want to couple it to some Gates field. But here you match up nicely, but if you have a two-form field, you don't even know how to match it. So there's a proposal from quite a while ago, and that is to say that now this collective field of these string-like objects, it has more degrees of freedom. And we parameterize those degrees of freedom by having this phase field, so it used to be a phase field, now it's actually vector value, and this is an integral over the Rossi components. And then if you look at the minimal coupling, in the end you end up with something like this. So here you have the Gates field, and now you have the fluctuations of the vector. So the collective field itself has more phase degrees of freedom if it comes from something which was shared. So this idea we will take and work with that. If you're only interested in the phenomenology, it just means that all the Gates degrees of freedom will be gaps, will be mixed. That's the end result. Okay, so this is what it looks like, right? So we start with this. This is the magnetic term of the phonons. This is the original coupling. And now I will make this collective field and we'll end up with this term, which I had on the previous slide. Okay, now I need to have a Ginsberg Landau potential, so now I have three separate dislocation components, x, y, and z, and this is all the possible Ginsberg Landau terms that you can write down, and it turns out actually that this is identical to the potential of the three-component Bose-Einstein composites, and again, according to the values of these parameters, you can condense one, two, or three of these dislocation fields. Yeah, so this is then what you end up with. If you start from the crystal, if you restore translations in the vertical directions, you have, by red that means something which is liquefied. So we restore translations, right? So here you have a periodic array of one-dimensional liquid lines. So that is analogous to a columnar liquid crystal. You could have stacked liquid planes, that is called smectic liquid crystal, or fully restored translational symmetry, which is what I call a metal liquid crystal. And all the time, rotational symmetry is still broken. So all of this is possible just by tuning these components.
So it's like, it goes from left to right, like the columnar is the first thing that appears once you break the symmetry in a particular direction.
If you want, you could do this step by step. If you choose, right, if you start from this, if you choose a certain set of parameters, one of these will be the result.
I see.
Yeah. But if you make this parameters function of something else and then increase that,
So far this is like a statement of if I fine-tune those couplings in your big Lagrangian, you can get either of these.
Yeah.
But in nature it might happen that, I don't know, as you tune the other parameter,
yeah.
It goes in a particular sequence.
Sequence or skip. Skip somewhere,
okay.
Maybe only magic. So this is basically the conclusions of my talk. Right, and everything here applies to also before. So the phonons now become two from Higgs bosons. The transverse phonons become gaps. The longitudinal phonon remains massless. And rotational modes emerge in planes with translational symmetry. So this is a quite interesting result. So here you see the counting of Goldstone modes in all these spaces. So in 2 plus 1 dimensions, so blue is the phonons, the translational Goldstone modes, and this red is the rotational Goldstone modes. In a solid, you just have two phonons, and then in a symmetric, which is stacked lines, you have one phonon still. And in a metric, you have no phonons, but you see the emergence of this rotational Goldstone mode that I had in the transverse conductivity plot here. And now in 3 plus 1 dimensions, it's the pattern as follows. The phonon reduces every time that you restore one translational degree of freedom. And then as if you have liquid planes, you have planes with rotational symmetry in the plane. Then you have a rotational Goldstone mode there in the plane. But only when you restore it, full translational symmetry, we find the two other rotational Goldstone modes from SF3 symmetry breaking. So we see this happen explicitly. You find these modes just coming out of the formula. Okay, and then if you're interested in experiments, these rotational Goldstone modes and also the massive, usually the massive transforms, they should be visible if you have the right instrument. Yeah, I think maybe better to stop here. I have something else to talk about, but it would be great if you can do the afterwards. Yeah.
Thanks, Adam.
Are there any more questions on 5 hours? I have one quick question. What would be the role of disorder? Because usually topological defects are pinned on disorder sets.
Mm-hmm.
So we
haven't looked into this. You could imagine that you want to do this combining of defects, but if they're pinned, you need an extra energy.
Yeah.
I mean, this may be a vortex and that vortex car already costs energy. If you're also on top of that pin, then maybe it costs even more. That's my first thought. So.
Okay, let's see, no more questions. I think Adam here, and he'll be here for the rest of the day. He leaves tomorrow morning, so if you still want to talk to him.